Thank you for being here, and I want to thank the committee for inviting us here. We have been having quite a time for the few days that we've been here, and it's going to be one of those unforgettable experiences. I am Clarence Snyder, and I am a recovered alcoholic. And every time I get up to make a talk, frankly, I never really know what's going to come out. But something usually does, and for a long time. So make yourselves comfortable, and I'll try. Of course, AA, you're supposed to tell about how it was, and what happened, and how it is now. I promise you I will not give you a drunkalogue. I see no point in it. But whatever comes out, why, it won't be a drunkalogue, I'm sure. But I got here by a series of miracles, and I feel that our whole fellowship here, the formation of this fellowship, is a result of miracles. And my coming here, I think you'll agree after I tell you about how it happened, it couldn't be anything else but a miracle. I was married to a girl, Dorothy. You'll find her name running all through that Dr. Bob book. And she was a member of a very clannish family. And her family invented togetherness. And that family was always together in my house. And they had some unusual traditions that they followed, one of which was they had family conferences in my house, to which I was never invited. I was usually the subject under discussion. And the discussion usually ran along the lines of whether they're going to throw me out again or let me back in again. I had been, in previous years, in the finance business, banking and finance. And I drank myself out of that, and I wound up on the bum. And I was between jobs for several years. And my wife's family were very much concerned about this lack of work on my part, and they were trying all the best they could do to get me to change my direction. And as it happened, they were all civilians. They were not alcoholics. And they were people that think. They use their heads. Alcoholics do not think. We emote. And we only do things when we feel like it. Well, they are a thinking crew, and they got a real bright idea one time. Her brother owned a big tractor trailer outfit, and he hauled merchandise between Cleveland and New York and back again. My home was in Cleveland. And they got the bright idea that they could kill two birds with one stone by getting me to go to work with my brother-in-law. This would give me a paying job. It also would enable him to ride herd on me and police me to see that I didn't drink. Now, this is good thinking. But, of course, you know what the good thinking amounts to. So I had to go along on this deal, and I started on a trip to New York with him. Now, that was probably pretty close to 50 years ago, almost that, 40-some. And to this day, I've never had my hands on the wheel of that truck because I got away from him in Albany on the way to New York City. And I don't have to tell you what happened. He had to pull that rig over the curb and finally rest. And he told me that he was going to take a nap for 2 or 3 hours. And I got away from him and started down the street to the first watering hole I could find. I had $1 and some change that he didn't know I had in my pockets. And so I had enough to get a start with. But the first watering hole I got into was too rich for my blood. So I went on down a few blocks and I found a place that was more suitable to a man of my estate. And I found an eager beaver in there. He was an angel. And some people might call him something else. But to me, he was an angel. And he started buying me drinks. And I was taking a minute's fast, he'd buy them. Well, finally, the thing got pretty risky there, so I thought I better be leaving, and I went in the bathroom, in the men's room, locked the door, and went out the window, and went back to the truck. And I left my newfound friend there waiting for me, which is going to be a long wait, as 40-some years ago. I got back to the truck, and my brother-in-law was sleeping on the seat. I was asleep up there by the little window in the back. And on the way back to the truck, apparently, those drinks probably all hit me because I had not had a drink for 2 days, which was a record for me. I was an everyday drinker. And by the time I got there and in my efforts to try to get up in my nest, I stepped on his poor boy's face. And of course, he came too, and church was out. He knew what was happening, and I got Hail Columbia. And he carried me on to New York City and threw me out and told me, this is the end of the line, don't ever come back home. This is my last chance. Well, I didn't have any money by that time. I had no clothes, only I had no overcoat. This is winter time again. As I say, everything happens to me in the winter for some reason or other. And I had to exist. And I existed a long time in New York City. And I want to tell you, an alcoholic, if you're a real rummy, you can exist any place. You take this desert out here, somebody sends a rummy out there in a desert where there's nothing around for 100 miles, you send him out for some water, he'll come back with a jug of corn. And so I was in New York City, and I might say all the time I was there, I never bought a meal, I never paid a night's room rent, and I never bought a stitch of clothes, and I start saving money. How do you like that? I'd been out of work for a long time, and these truckers come over there, they wanted someone to watch their outfit. Well, they went and got a bed for the night and had a night on the town waiting for a load back wherever they were heading for. They used to pay me 50 cents a night to sleep in their outfit as a watchman. 50 cents a night. Anyone could have stolen that outfit with me in it, but they didn't know I was drunk all the time. I had 2 jugs of corn with me all the time. I might say that when you get down to the nitty-gritty of things in drinking, one does not cut down on the amount of his drinking, only the quality of it. And I was paying 7 cents a pint for my booze, and I bought it in a wallpaper store. I was drinking derail, we call it. Some people call it smoke. It's strictly nothing but denatured alcohol mixed with anything you want to mix it with, mostly water. But it does the job. But believe me, don't start out on that stuff. You have to work yourself down to that. You have to get conditioned. But if you want to save money drinking, there is my solution. I could tell you how I ate. I'm going to tell you, if you ever get on the bum, fellas and gals, go to New York. There are more suckers per square mile in New York City than any place else. And they are all available. I'm a guy that wanders around and gets his nose into things. And New York was a this is an adventure. But I was adventuring because I had to. I had gone out to my sister-in-law's house in Yonkers. I thought she would take me in when her brother had thrown me out. So I knew where she lived because she lived way up on a hill in Yonkers. I'd been there on my honeymoon. As I say, we did everything together in that family. But I got out there, instead of going up on a hill, I went down a hill, and I got into the Italian section down there. And those were bootleg days, and all Italians had wine. Most of them made it, and a lot of them sold it, and I guess they all drank it, and some of them shared it with their friends. And I went down there and made friends. And time I got up to Virginia's house, I was a sight for sore eyes. Well, I can't remember too much about that visit to her home, except that I was rolling around on the floor with her two little girls, little babies. They were probably 2, 3, 4 years old, just little tykes. And they were having a lot of fun, but Virginia didn't see much fun in this. She took a dim view of this. So she threw me in the back of her car and took me downtown and threw me out where her brother had thrown me out. And that was it. So I had to exist. So here's how I existed in New York. This is only parts of my past drinking that I probably will talk about very much, because somebody may need this. You may go on the bum sometime. I want you to know how to conduct yourself in New York. I watched things going on, and I found something very interesting in New York City. I found an automat. I don't know if any of you folks have been around an automat, but they had them in Philadelphia and they had them in New York. And the automat was a place where you go, where people are in a big hurry to get their lunch, and they put nickels and so forth in little slots, and they get out sandwiches or soup or coffee or whatever they want. And I watched people in New York City, and everyone's in a hurry. You never find anybody lolling along like they do down south. Everybody's just running back and forth. And at noontime, it's a calamity there. They all tear out of those offices and run out to get something to eat. And I think most of them have a half hour for lunch, so some of them don't go to restaurants. They go to the automat. And they don't even bother to sit down when they eat. They get their little stuff out of there and get up at a table, and they eat, and they're talking to one another, and they never even know what they're eating. So this gave me an idea. The old rummy bean working. Here's where to get some good food. So I tried an experiment. I'm sort of a student of human nature, you know. I've always have been, which helped me a lot later on when I got into sales work. I went out on the curbstone and rubbed my one hand in the dirt along the curbstone and made it good and grimy. And I sidled up alongside a couple of these guys that are talking at each other and they don't even know what they're eating. And I reached up with this dirty hand and put it in this one guy's plate and start taking something off his plate. It takes a little crust to do this. But what happens, human nature takes over. The guy, the first thing he wants to do is belt me. But I look up at him with those baleful eyes, I'm hungry, I'm starving, and he gets so frustrated he walks away and leaves the whole bloody thing, and that's what I want in the first place. Now, I didn't have to eat every day, and you couldn't pull that scam every day either, because you had to regulate your time somewhat, but I wasn't much on eating anyway, but you had to eat to keep the body and soul alive. Clothes, if I needed something, I would go to the mission. I never could handle mission food. Even the thought of it today makes me sick. I'm convinced that in these missions, they get this stale bread that they can't sell in these bakeries and groceries, and they just hand it to a mission. And it sits around there, and if you've ever been in any missions, you know that all you can smell in those places is bug juice. They spray everything and everybody that comes in. So that bug juice, that's odors everywhere, and of course it picks up in those donuts and all that stuff that's been laying around there for a week or so. So those donuts lay there and nobody eats the bloody things, so I think they just turn them over to another mission when they get tired of looking at them or they get a little bitty cruddy. So you try to eat that stuff, and it's just not possible. I can't anyway. But I found out how to eat without eating at the missions. But missions were good for clothes. If you needed some shoes, which you often lose because people steal them on you, and shoes or anything else you need, you go to the mission. You have to sing. You don't have to be a marvelous singer or anything, so long as you sing. and you go ahead and hit that sawdust trail, they'll give you whatever you need. So you don't have to buy clothes in New York. This is not going to be known as an Oxford group. We are taking the name from this book that just came out, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to be called Alcoholics Anonymous. And only, here's what blew the top, the roof off the house. And only alcoholics and their family are welcome, nobody else. Well, we were a minority down there, and those people have been awful good to us. And I'm shutting them out, shutting all those people out from our activity. Boy, you should have heard the uprising. Clarence, you can't do this. It's done. You got to come down and talk about it. There's nothing to talk about it. Oh, it was awful. It was a riot. But I thought that was a riot. I wish you'd have seen next Thursday night up on Stillman Road in Cleveland Heights. That whole group came up to there and descended upon us and tried to break up our meeting. One guy was going to whip me. Bill Jones was going to give me a lathering. And I must say, this was all done in pure Christian love. But we stood our ground, and that's the way AA started. AA started in a riot, and it grows in riots. Nobody starts a group because we need a group. Somebody gets mad at somebody. That's what I call unity. Whoever started that unity jazz, I mean, that guy should have his head examined, whoever did that. If we ever had unity in AA, you know what we'd have? We'd have one great big group, three people doing the work, and everybody else getting drunk. We have to have leaders. We have to have people to get out there and beat those bushes and do the job. And everybody can't sit in the back row. Alcoholics are not made that way. We are a breed different than people. We are. We are not like people. We are different. Alcoholics are a breed of cats entirely different, and everybody can't be an alcoholic. Remember that. To be an alcoholic is a privilege reserved for a chosen few. I don't care how much people drink. Some people can never become alcoholic. I drank with a lot of these birds, could drink an awful lot of booze, but they could quit drinking any time they got a different hobby. I couldn't do that. I don't think there's over 8 or 9 or probably at the most 10% of the population who can be alcoholic. Most of these heavy drinkers I see don't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. You have to have something on the ball to be a rummy. How can you and I, think of the stuff we pulled off while we were drinking. I see alcoholics can operate on probably 20% of their efficiency and beat the socks off of Earth's people that are operating on 80% of theirs. Yeah. I can give you a lot of examples of that, and even in my own experience. No, alcoholics are a type. And here are some of the characteristics to look for in a rummy. I've never met an alcoholic worthy of the name yet. There was not a high-strung individual. I never met one that wasn't quick on the trigger. He's not a deep thinker. He don't think. He emotes. He'll do something. He'll act. But don't get him to thinking. He gets in trouble. One of the biggest insults to an alcoholic is to walk into an AA group and see a think sign hanging up there. That is absolutely an insult to us. They should take them down. You know how those think signs got into AA? A boy down in old Phil Haswell, he was a great old guy, but he got thinking once, which is fatal for an alcoholic. He got a hold of a whole bale of these think signs that the IBM used to give out to the different people in offices around the country, and they used to hang them over the water fountain there to inspire the help in the office. And he thought it'd be a great idea to send those around, and he got the directory, I guess, and sent those to every blooming group in the country and out of the country, and they dutifully hung them up. Think. If he'd have put up there not think, but scheme, then we got something. Alcoholics are very sensitive souls. They're always going around looking for someone to hurt their feelings. They're the biggest liars that ever wore shoes. They lie when they don't have to. They lie for practice. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they're very social people. They want to have someone, but they're afraid. They hold you at arm's length. They never let anybody get too close to them. They don't. They are born and reared in fear. And this is one of our biggest enemies, is fear. And every one of us that I've ever met, when you look back on his life, I know in my own instance, I was raised on fear. I raised on it in Sunday school when I was a little kid. I raised on it at home. If you do this, you're going to hell. If you don't do this, you're going to hell. I'm always going to hell. Never heard of me going anyplace else. Fear, fear, fear. What do you think that does to a person in your formative years? That stays with you. One of the biggest problems we have is overcome fear. That's first. I've never met an alcoholic that did not have what they call an inferiority complex, a feeling of inadequacy. One of the first things I have to do when I ever work with an alcoholic is to build him up. I try to make him get a decent feeling about himself because he don't believe it. Everybody's been telling him what a slob he is for so long. He's got a very poor self-image when he gets here. Some people work just the opposite of that, and that's why they cripple so many alcoholics coming to AA. First thing, make that guy think he's something. I tell him why he's somebody. I tell him this, and it's the truth. I don't care what line of work an alcoholic, the real alcoholic, I'm not talking about the stupid drunk, I'm talking about the alcoholic. I don't care what he's in, if he's a teacher, if he's a lawyer, a doctor, if he's a salesman, if he's a mechanic, whatever he is, you'll always find him in the top 10. He is superior. When I came into this fellowship, I couldn't go back in the banking business. I probably blackballed, and I don't think I could have handled it anyway. I had to change everything. I went into sales work. And I've been in sales work for many years till I decided it's easier to loaf than work, so I don't work anymore. But I've sold a lot of things, a lot of things. Most of the things I've sold have been, I've sold big ticket items and little ticket items, but I've sold intangible. I sell ideas. And I know in selling, I've also been a sales manager for a number of outfits. I've trained salesmen, so I know what they need, and I know what has to be cultivated in them. But you and I are salesmen, and we have to learn to judge and to analyze people. Since you can't judge people, what do you mean you can't judge people? You get a sixth sense about people when you deal with them long enough. I've been dealing with alcoholics for over 44 years. They can't tell me anything new. I've heard every story they ever told. You tell me a new story about rummies, I'll be glad to listen to it, but you can't do it. In 44 years, you've heard them all. And I've met a lot of rummies, and I've listened to a lot of their ploys and seen a lot of their workings. And I know just what's coming next all the time with them, really. And you do this in sales work, same way. I learned, and the salesman only has his time, and I find out in selling, and remember, we're selling AA, don't you ever forget that, it's the greatest sales job you're doing. When you're selling anything, you have to know your product first. You have to have enthusiasm for it, second. You have to know how to present it in a way that's acceptable, third. You got to know who you're talking to, fourth. You got to qualify your prospect, fifth. Same way, that's what I did in my business. I was a very successful salesman, always. I'm not bragging about it. The record stands for itself. I've sold education. I've sold correspondence courses for years. I've sold franchises. You name it, I've sold it. And I know what I have to do to sell. And I know what I have to do to sell AA. I learned that this AA selling the hard way. And I just try to pass along some of these things to save you a lot of bumps. To profit by experience. You don't have to learn everything the hard way. I had to learn a lot of things the hard way. You don't have to. You know, I'm just outlining some of these things about the early days of AA to give you an idea what you have here. When we started our group in Cleveland, the first AA group in the world, I remember very distinctly one night looking at that crowd up at Goldrick's house. And I said to myself, boy, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had as many as 35 members here, eh? Do you know it wasn't 2 years' time we had 35 groups in Cleveland? Eh? And when I said that night, it would be impossible for anyone to ever even conceive that AA would be what it is today. It's everywhere. Every town you go into, every country you go into, you name it, AA is there. Eh? At one time, there's nothing. A dozen guys. Eh? Why does it go like this? We have something. You know about alcoholics? Let me tell you something about alcoholics and alcoholism. Alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. You read about alcoholism in ancient history. You read about it in mythology. And you read about it in the Bible. There's a lot of good rummy stories in the Bible. Tomorrow I think I'll tell you some of them, because it's Sunday, we'll have a Sunday school lesson. What I'm trying to say is alcoholism's been with us for a long, long time. I think I said the other night, I have a book about yay thick on the history of alcoholism that was written back in the early 1800s, and it goes back centuries, laying out what people try to do to modify alcoholics drinking, and everything failed. Never anything succeeded. As you heard last night when Marinello was talking, there was only two ways. I know, I mentioned that the other night too. The only two places people, rummies, could go before AA, one was a Samaritan cure and one was a Keeley cure. Both of them were aversion treatments. They just stuff you full of beer and wine and whiskey and put Epicac in it and make you sick as a dog. With the idea that if you get so sick, you never want to look at it again. Well, it never worked. These guys get drunk on the way home from there. But we have the answer here. We have the answer in AA. You know what I think happened? All these centuries, alcoholics, millions of them, have stumbled across the face of this earth. And they existed and died in alcoholism, in misery, in disgrace, and in many instances carried their own families and some of their friends down with them. This has been going on for centuries. There's no out. The alcoholic only had two options all this time, all these centuries. He could go crazy or die or both. Finally, Alcoholics Anonymous came into being, and this is a big moment in history. Believe me, this is probably the most important thing that happened in this century or any century, in my estimation. The alcoholic got a third option. He can still go crazy, he can still die, but he can get well. He can now get well. Never could happen to before. This is why so many strange people came bounding on my door up there in Cleveland in those early days. They couldn't understand what was going on. What do you do to these people? How is this happening? It had never happened before. I was mentioning the other night, somewhere, I was born in 1902. And if you look back in this century, a lot of marvelous things have happened. I saw the beginning of the automobile industry. I saw the beginning of the airplane industry. I saw the beginning of radio. I saw the beginning of television. I've seen men land on the moon. I've seen terrific things happen in the development in science and medicine in this century. But I'm standing here to tell you I don't think any of them are near as important as what happened in 1938. May when this program got going. You and I are God's chosen people. The Jews like to say they are the chosen people, and they are. They're chosen twice if they happen to be a rummy. But you and I are chosen to do something that no one else can do. You and I have a ministry in working with alcoholics, and there isn't one person sitting in this room that is not an authority. Because you've been through that mill, you have something to share, and you have something to sell. And you can do it, and all the smart people in the world have tried, and they can't. But you and I, as rummies, can do this. Let me tell you something about some of these things that happened. You know, after we got going for a while in Cleveland, in the fall, we got going in May there, in the fall, I found a newspaper man out in a bug house. He'd been probated by his wife. And a little guy, and a non-alcoholic man, a little Jewish insurance man called me. This Jerry Halley called me about this fella. Says, this guy is worth salvaging. And his wife's got him put away in a bug house out here. You ought to go out and see if you can't fix him. Do something with him. So Jerry and I went out to see Elrick Davis. And I talked to Elrick about this thing. And boy, all he wants to do is get out of that joint. So he's willing to do anything. So I gave him the book, copy of the book. Told him to read it. And I said, if you get out of here, maybe you can write something and get yourself started back in the newspaper field. It's all right with him. But then I had to go out and sell his wife on the idea of letting him out. That wasn't as easy as talking to him, believe me. But she did. She got him released. And he wrote these articles in the Cleveland Plain Dealer in the fall of 1938, or 39 rather. And that's the thing that put AA on its, on the way to where it's going. We had publicity there for a week. Another writer wrote for 3 days, then a minister there who tried to fix me years before preached a sermon. I went back to see this minister a year after I was sober, and he didn't know me. I gave that guy an awful lot of aggravation. I didn't think he'd ever forget me. But I looked different a year later. When finally dawned on who I was, he couldn't believe it. And then I told him about this, and he wanted to meet some of these men. Then he went to work and preached a sermon, and he used my life story as his sermon topic. He preached his sermon, Mr. X and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the Mr. X. And he had the Plain Dealer the next morning published his sermon on Monday morning in the paper. They used to publish somebody's sermon every Monday morning. They picked his that time, fortunately for us. And then he had that sermon put in pamphlet form. That's the first pamphlet AA ever had. And he had them printed, and he gave them to us, how many we needed. Well, that's the way all of those inquiries from the Plain Dealer came through my hands. And all of them that came to him came through my hands, and all that came that other contacts I was making. And here's the way we started. Here's the way we did things. I'd give every man a handful of these on Monday morning and tell him to go out and come back to tell me Wednesday what he did with them all. Just like a sales manager. And they did it. They were crazy to go out and work. Those guys are running wild around Cleveland and around those places. At night, I sat at home writing correspondence courses in AA to people out of state and out of the city, people that wrote in. I'd answer those. I also chased some of them down myself. Well, people came in so fast, we were having an awful time trying to absorb them, because we didn't have all that many men. So I was trying to find out some way that we could train these people in classes. I didn't have any money to rent a hall, and I was trying, and I was asking the good Lord to give me some direction on this, as we always asked him for a direction in everything. So one day I went out chasing some of these down, and I had one of them in my hand there, the name of Walter Beilstein. Well, means nothing to me, but the address was in a neighborhood that had been declining somewhat. They had these big homes down there, these millionaires' homes, these 24-room houses and that, with the carriage house in the rear. And I got out there, and this is what they call Little Hollywood in Cleveland. It was declining, and there was a lot of hustlers and what have you out there. And this was a funeral parlor, Beilstein Funeral Home. And I went up on the porch, and I went in, and I asked for Walter Beilstein. And the guy says, "Who?" I says, "Walter Beilstein." He says, Walter. Then I know I'm in the right place. He says, "He's not in here. He lives up over the carriage house in the rear. You'll find him up there." So I go back and go upstairs and rap on the door, and here comes this guy to the door. Walter. He's wearing a beret. And in those days, guys with berets were looked upon with some suspicion. Well, anyway, Walter comes to the door. He's very affable, he's very polite, and he's very drunk. And he invited me in. So I go in that place, and boy, one look at that place, and it's a theater. He's got a hold of about 200 picture show seats from some show that went out of business, and he has them stapled to the floor, and one end of his place is a stage with all the drops and props and stuff. And he lives in the other end. He has his bath and his kitchen and all that stuff in his bed in the other end. And I look at that place. I've been praying for a place to train people in classes. I said, "Walter." "Yeah." I said, "You are a gift from heaven." He says, "I am." "You sure are." I says, "You know what we're going to do, Walter?" See, Walter was putting on amateur theatricals up there. That was his hobby. He had one other hobby. He had a Great Dane dog. And I wish you'd seen this dog. 165 pounds. It's like a horse running around the house up there. That was his chum, that horse, that dog. That was real some dog. Playful thing. He'd get up on you, knock you on your can. You know, he liked to do that. Well, 165 pounds can do it. Well, Walter, I says, "You know what we're going to do?" He says, "What?" I says, "We're going to fill those seats every night." That's all he wants to hear. He wants those seats filled up. I says, "How many seats you got?" He says, "I don't know, about 200. We'll fill them up every night. Well, that's all he likes, get those seats filled up. Of course, he thought we were going to run some shows or something. But you know, I made Walter a captain. Walter, you are a captain in AA. He's the first and only captain we ever had. So Walter, everybody used to call him Captain Walter. And he loved that title. And old Walter got busy, and he forgot all about drinking. And he was a real captain around there, and he was having the time of his life. Because nobody paid any attention to Walter. He was an outcast with his family and everybody else. Well, Walter never knew anything about girls. Walter was in his early 30s, a nice fella. And he got running around to these hospitals where we had drunks, and he saw girls. And he meets a girl, a nurse, and he looks at that nurse, and Walter, funny things start happening. Walter, in here, he got an itch that he couldn't scratch. And he starts to get acquainted with this gal, this nurse. The next thing you know, he's courting her. And the next thing you know, Walter asks her to marry him. This is the only gal Walter ever knew. So this girl agreed to marry Walter on one condition. That dog was too much in the house. The dog would have to go. Well, that dog was his boon companion. He loved that dog, and the dog loved him, and this was a terrible decision for Walter to make. And he stewed about that for a week or so. But you know, love will conquer all. So Walter, finally, he broke down, and he gave the dog to some people way out in the country, and they got married. Well, things were steaming along pretty well for a while, and I noticed Walter is starting to get slowing up. He isn't his same old self. Something's wrong with Walter. So I said, Walter, come over here, boy. I said, something wrong with you. Tell Papa what's wrong here. Tell me what's wrong. What's eating of you? He said, I miss my dog. I says, well, I'm sure you do, Walter, but you made a deal with Mary. I still want my dog. I said, well, Walter, I know that you made a deal, and Mary isn't about to have that dog move in, but I said, you might talk to her. Maybe she'll give you weekend visiting privileges. I didn't think she would, but hope springs eternal. So he talked to Mary about having the privileges, but she refused that, too. So Walter liked that dog and loved that dog, so he threw her out and got the dog back. I'll tell you, we had characters you wouldn't believe. We had those men coming up there every night of the week to Walter Beilstein's house, back at the funeral home. They come up those stairs, and here's something that happened. The neighbors are wondering what's going on upstairs in that, over that, behind that funeral home. All these men, 100 or so men streaming up there every night, they know there's something nefarious going on up there. So they want to know what's going on in their neighborhoods, or they send the police over. So one evening, the cops come in, and the sergeant comes in. I greet him at the door and ask him his pleasure. He says, I want to talk to you about what are you guys doing up here? And he's looking around. He recognizes a lot of those birds in there because they've been customers of his in a wagon for year after year. I says, and I told him, we fixed these guys. We sober them up. He said, you mean to say that one's sober and that one's sober and that? So go smell them. They don't drink? No, they don't drink. They ain't going to drink. They'll never drink again. I thought, what faith we had. So he looks his bunch over and they left. There's nothing he could do. A couple nights later, a little old lady come charging up there. And she wants to know what's going on in her neighborhood. It's full of these men, and she recognizes some of these birds because she's been sweeping them off her lawn in the morning and stuff like this. And she wants to know, and I told her the same thing I told the cops. She said, you mean those guys are not drinking? That one and that one? That? No. You mean they're not going to drink? Never. They'll never drink. And she softened up. She says, I have a boy. He's on the bum somewhere. Can you fix him, too? Sure, we can fix anybody. I said, where is he? She says, he's in New York. Oh. She says, whereabouts in New York? I don't know. He's on Skid Row. Skid Row in New York, that's something to find, some rummy from Cleveland. I says, well, I tell you, we have some guys up in New York. So I gave her Bill Wilson's name, the address. I says, we got some guys up there. I'll get in touch with them. First, I says, I'll get in touch with them. She said, no, who do you have? So I give her Bill's name and address. That old lady's on the first rattler going to New York the next morning. And she confronts Bill, of course. But here's what happened. The very day, she had a daughter living in New York City. Now, she hadn't heard from her son for about 2 years. He used to be a sales manager for one of the big distilleries. He was advertising manager for Calvert Distilling Company. I think he believed his ads too well. And he wound up on Skid Row. The very day she'd landed in New York at her daughter's place, this guy called his sister while his mother was there. What do you call that? She hadn't heard from him for a couple of years. What do you call that? So they got a hold of this bird. You know what happened to that guy? He became the first editor of our Grapevine. He's lived a sober life for many years. He just died about 2 years ago. Wonderful fellow. Here's the old lady in Cleveland. Her boy is out there on the Skid Row in New York. And it brings it all together. And he comes in here and he's a very active person in this AA activity the rest of his life. Wonderful fellow. He got married, beautiful wife he had, Several years ago, she died. I remember that so well. He just passed away a short time ago himself. He just passed away a short time ago himself. These miracles that come along that happen, it's hard for people to believe this. Now talk about women. We like to talk about women. There were no ladies in AA in those days. Doc Smith and Bill Wilson were against female alcoholics. They were poison. In those days, there was a terrible double standard as far as women were concerned. Any woman that got drunk was a bum in everybody's estimation. I mean, that was it. She was a hooker in everybody's estimation. She was a lot less than what a lady should be. And they didn't want them. The first gal that I ever sponsored, she was in a hospital in Chicago. Get this, Chicago. She'd been in and out of that hospital numerous times with booze and pills. I had a sister-in-law as a nurse in that hospital. And Carolyn said to this gal one day, she says, "Hey, you ought to go to Cleveland and see my brother-in-law, my ex-brother-in-law. And he fixes drunks, and he can fix you." She got on a train and came to Cleveland and came and moved into my house for about 3 weeks. I was still with Dorothy then. And I looked everywhere to find these pills. I went to all the hems of her garments, to her bags, to every place that was legal. I looked for these pills and I couldn't find them. But finally she got straightened up and she went back to Chicago. When she went back there, I gave her Earl Treat's name. Earl had been in the Oxford movement in Akron when I was down there, and his business took him to Chicago, and he didn't do anything about fixing drunks out there. He was sitting on his big fat behind. She went out there, and she lit a candle under that old boy, and they went out, along with Grace Cullis. They started the Chicago group. That's the one girl. I want to tell you about another gal. Tell you about several of them. First, I'll tell you about one that when I was living in this boarding house, this little gal was named Marie. She was a hooker, and her territory was out in front of my house, this boarding house. She had two blocks that she walked up and down, and business was always poor in those days. After all, there was a depression on. And she had a nuisance value. She'd come into my boarding house, where I was living, and she'd come right back to my room, and she'd put the arm on me for a quarter. She had a two-bit nuisance value to get rid of her. And I was in trouble with old lady Mac, the landlady. She didn't like that hooker coming in there. She said, "We got enough broads around here now. We don't have to get him in out of the streets." And I was about ready to get thrown out of there because of her coming in there. Of course, the old lady Mac didn't understand what was going on here. So finally, I had to figure out some way to get rid of this gal. She, meantime, had gone into AA. And she got enamored of some guy, and this romance blossomed for about 6 weeks. And then this guy dumped her for somebody else, and she went back on the street again. So she's parading up and down, coming in and bothering me all the time. Well, anyway, I got to find some way to get rid of her in a humane fashion. So I went to the state liquor store. I hadn't been in one of these stores for a long time. In fact, I wasn't allowed in them while I was drinking. They got a law in Ohio. You can't go in there drunk, and I was always drunk. I went in and said to this guy running the state liquor store, "What do you have here, the worst whiskey you got in the place? Something that'll turn people inside out." He looked at me like I'm Daffy. I said, "Yeah, I mean it." He said, "You do?" He said, "Well, I think I got something for you." So he went out in the back of the place and brought a quart bottle of Old Cotton Picker. Old Cotton Picker is a Kentucky corn whiskey. And it was one, it cost me 90 cents for the quart. So it wasn't the greatest, you know. And I take my Old Cotton Picker and take it home and put it in my drawer at home. Sure enough, Marie comes floating in another night or so and wants a drink. I says, Marie, you are in good fortune. I have a drink right here for you. You don't have to go out scrounge for it. I got a drink right here. Oh, she was happy about that. I says, but I tell you what, Marie, I'm in trouble here with old lady Mac. And I want you to drink this drink right down and get out of here and don't come back. Do me a favor. I've been trying to be good to you, but take this down and blow. Don't bother me anymore. Okay. I poured her out a water glass full of Old Cotton Picker. I says, now take this and drink it down. Don't even take a breath. And she did. And boy, when that hit her, you think you hit her on the head with a mallet. She fell on her butt, and there she lay. She had knocked her flatter than a rug. So I dragged her out of there, and that was the last time she ever came back for a drink. But I kept the cotton picker, and there's Paul Simon was a fellow that was a cast-off of a very wealthy family, and he was living in that place. And he had a pal that he used to go to college with. This guy's family were multimillionaires. They had polo ponies and all that stuff out in Gates Mills out east of Cleveland. And this Robbie was a pretty boy. He had real wavy black hair. He looked more like a girl than anything else. And Paul was trying to get him to come to get dried out on Post Shaker Sanitarium. So finally, and he hated my guts. This fellow Robbie hated me like the devil hates holy water. And every time we'd run into each other, he would tell me something about my ancestors and all this stuff. And I just irritated this guy. We just had a personality clash. Well, anyway, Paul said, finally come back there one noon. He says, Robbie's out here and he wants to go in, but he wants a drink first. You got anything to drink? Now, that guy wouldn't wash his feet in Seagram's Seven Crown. He had the best of everything. He was a millionaire kid. I said, yeah, I just have the drink for Robbie. Just the thing. So I pour a water glass full of this Old Cotton Picker and go up to Robbie's room with it, and as soon as I go in, why, Robbie greets me with the usual four-letter words, and I respond in kind. And I start to irritate him. And I said to him, I said, you know, you want a drink. You look more like a girl than a boy. I don't think you know anything about drinking. I says, you drink like a girl. You look like a girl. I think you are a girl. You're not a man. And he get mad as a wet hen, see? So he says, I'll show you I can drink. I said, you can't drink. Yeah, I'll show you. All right, you show me. Let me see you drink this water glass full of booze without taking a breath. I'll show you, you SOB. And he takes that, grug, 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 down he went. We picked him up and threw him in a car and took him in there, and that's the last drink Robbie ever had. It's the last drink he ever had. He sobered up. If he's living, he's still sober today. After a year or so, we got on good terms, but there you had to irritate this guy. You give them what treatment they need. You have to know your prospect when you're selling this. Okay. Well, now, let me tell you about a girl. Somebody said I only got a short time on the tape. I can't worry about tapes. Are you worried about tapes? You know, there was a girl, I made a lot of contacts with social workers and people like that. And Miss Mooney was a social worker. She sent me several men, whom we fixed. She called me up one day and says, do you fix women? Sure, we fix women. We didn't have any, but we fixed them just the same. She says, I got one for you. So I went down to meet this genius that she had. This girl's name was Catherine. Catherine was very thin. I used to call her old 6 o'clock. She's straight up and down. Had about as much shape as a lead pencil. And she was Irish, and she's rather young, and she had the most filthy mouth of any person I ever heard. She could swear. I never heard anything like it. As I've often said, I think she taught sailors how to swear. So there she was. She had belonged to a very wealthy family once, and they threw her out because she'd been playing patty cake with one of her uncles and broke up his home. And she was on her own, but she'd been educated abroad. She had a good education. And she was on the street, and Catherine would do anything for a drink. Anything. And she looked it. So Mooney introduced me to Catherine, and so everything went fine. A couple of weeks were getting along great. Catherine isn't drinking, and things are going good. I used to go home at noon, go to the rooming house at noon, a lot of times to get away from the store. And one day I'm walking down the corner to the drugstore, and here comes Catherine up my direction, and she's so drunk she can't hit the sidewalk with her hat. She is really drunk. Catherine had been out to that Warrensville workhouse so many times that she was serving a life sentence on the installment plan. She'd go in for 30, 60 days, come back, and back out again. That was her home away from home. So here she's drunk. So I said, Catherine, you just got out of the pokey. You're going to go right back in. Let's get home. So I wanted to take her home. Okay. So she was Irish, and she was really had a loud mouth and a dirty one. And she suddenly decided she wants something to eat. Now, this is noontime. This is happening. Well, I know that Catherine is not capable of doing much on the eat side, so I try to steer her into a Greek restaurant there, and she looks in there and looks at me. She says, I wouldn't eat in a dump like that. It had those enamel tables, you know. She says, I'm a lady. I want a tablecloth where I eat. That bum. Oh, so I try to humor her, and I want to get her off the street, and I made a terrible error. I took her down to 79th Street, and there's a nice spaghetti restaurant down there, an Italian restaurant. Carpets on the floor, tablecloths, and men waiters with the dickies and the whole thing, you know, tuxedos they're wearing. So we go in there, and as soon as we got in there, I knew that I had made the mistake of a century. Because she's loud, she is profane, and she stinks. And we go in there, and the head waiter meets us and takes us to a table, and she's having a few words with him on the way. And we get seated, and he leaves, and she flings a few remarks as he goes. The waiter came and took her order, and she ordered spaghetti. I know she has about much chance of handling spaghetti as I have climbing over that building. But she ordered it. Well, meantime, she's having some problems with the people in the next table over here. And she's exchanging pleasantries with them about their ancestors. And now remember, these are all professional and business people having lunch in there. It's a nice, refined place. They're not used to any such stuff. So that ain't bad enough. She's having trouble over here with another table and then a table behind her. The next thing you know, the whole damn restaurant's in an uproar. The head waiter comes back and tries to shush her, and she tells him a few things. He blows. The waiter then brings her spaghetti and sets it down, and she dismisses him. And then she starts to wear this spaghetti. She sure can't eat it. It's coming down here. By this time, as I say, that restaurant's in an uproar. And the head waiter comes back and advises us we have to leave. Well, she don't like this guy because he represents authority. She'd had trouble with him before. And he had the nerve to come back and tell her to get out, and she don't like this, so she did nothing but pick up that plate of spaghetti and give it to him right in the kisser all over his, run down over his dickie. Well, in about 2 minutes, the wagon was there. and Catherine and I are both in the wagon. Down we go to the pokey. They put Catherine in some place back, and they left me out in the front there. They put me in a cage out front here. And I'm rattling this bloody cage, and I'm trying to tell these monkeys in there that I don't belong here, and they assured me nobody does. And I'm making a lot of noise, and finally I give up. It's no use. I'm stuck. So I just lay down and rest a while, and finally they changed shifts. A new bunch of cops came on. So I started my rattling all over again, and one guy came over to see what's going on here. And I told him, I says, you just call, what's his name,
Crowley.
Yeah, call Crowley, the probation officer. He'll tell you all about me. He said, you know Crowley? I said, sure. You know, call him and see. I don't belong in here. He'll tell you about it. So I guess he called Crowley, because they didn't even let me call anybody, if you can imagine that. So Crowley had a fit. He laughed. He thought it was the funniest thing. I get pinched with that broad. So he came down and got me out. But they kept Catherine. Well, they took Catherine away and she was gone. I didn't see any more of Catherine for some time, a month or so. I'm walking up to the drugstore again. This is a dangerous place for me to walk. And here comes Catherine again. And if anything, she's drunker than she was the other time. I said, Catherine, you just got out. You'll go right back in again. Let's get off the street. Let's go home. She said, okay. I said, we don't eat today, Catherine. Okay. Now, she was so bad that I was afraid to cross Euclid Avenue with her. So I took her up to 82nd Street where there was a light up there, a traffic light, where I could cross in some semblance of safety with her. And I'll never forget that corner. There's a Unitarian church on one side and a Jewish temple across the street. And I'm waiting for this light with Catherine, and all of a sudden she feels the call of nature. And don't you know, she squats right there. And I'm standing there holding her hand. And she's rocking around. This would make a good movie. You know? It's high noon and all the people, there's 1,000 people walking around the street there. And a lot of interested passers-by stop. And she has a word with them. And they have a word. And as it goes on, there's a crowd coming around pretty soon. You don't know what's coming next. That damn wagon showed up again. Down we go. And I'm in that place again. So I can't get any place with these birds. Same dummies in there. So I wait till 3:30 or whenever it was when the new crop came on. And this guy saw me. I thought he'd have a hemorrhage laughing. So Crowley, he called Crowley. Somebody had to get me out. They wouldn't let me out. So Crowley had fits when I get caught twice with that crazy broad. So I got out, but they took Catherine again. So between Mooney and Crowley and the judge, I told him, there's no way this girl's ever going to live unless she's put away for a long period of time. She can't possibly exist. She's going to die this way. I recommended that I give her a sentence as a habitual, give her a year and a day. And the judge did. He gave her a year and a day. Well, I know Catherine knew I had a hand in this, so I dare not go around to see her because, oh boy. But I knew someday I'd have to. So one day the matron called me and told me Catherine wants to see me. So I went down to the dime store and bought her some gumdrops and some stink water and some talcum powder and some cigarettes. I think I invested 60 cents in her, which was a big investment for me. And I had them in a bag and I headed out there 18 miles to Warrensville. Man, when I went in there, the air got blue. I'm telling you, that girl could swear. I never heard this going on. This was all directed at me this time. And she went on and on. There's nothing I could do but wait till she run down. All she wants is out of there. I says, Catherine, you're not leaving here. You're staying a year and a day. Of course, then the balloon goes up again, you know. Oh, it was something. So finally, after the second tantrum she had, they had a little thing. I could put this thing through and give it to her. And she accepted my little peace offering. And I went out to see that crazy woman every week, the whole year she was out there. And after I went a few times, she quit hollering about getting out. She knew she wasn't going to get out. But here's the end of the story, as Paul Harvey says. That gal, they put her in the hospital ward out there and got her cleaned up. That girl probably had everything from dandruff to fallen arches, the kind of life she was living, you know? And they didn't have those wonder drugs like they have today. But they cleaned her up, and she started getting some meat on her bones, and she stayed there for her whole year. And when she got ready to go, Mooney and I went out to pick her up, and we brought her in, and Mooney got her a room way out by Euclid Beach Park, away from all the places she'd been before, living with some old bohemian people, knew nothing about alcoholics, and got her a job on one of the Cleveland's bathing beaches as a lifeguard. She could swim like a fish. She worked there all year till Labor Day when the beach closed. And Mooney got her a job at one of the hotels as a room clerk. And she went to night school and took refresher course in her typing and shorthand, which she knew something about. And she got a job as a secretary. She saved her money. That girl was the tightest person I ever saw in my life. As I've often said, she wouldn't spend a dime to see the original crucifixion. But she was saving her money for a purpose. Finally, she went into the real estate business and she became a very wealthy woman. I tried to take her to a meeting one night and the women threw her out. They wouldn't have her. I took her to a meeting up at that home at Goldrick's home. The women wouldn't have her in there. But I took her to some picnics in places where she didn't have any identity. But she went back into her church. She was Irish and she was Catholic. She hadn't been in a church in a long time. But an odd thing, she was very good with kids. And she worked with young people and with kids in that church. And that's what she dedicated her time to, working with these kids. She was very good at it. That woman became wealthy. The last I heard of her, she was living in Palm Beach, Florida. Still single, still waiting for me. That girl taught me something that no one could have taught me. They used to say in those days, if a woman goes a certain way down, there's no coming back. She refuted all that stuff. Nobody in my experience has ever gone near as low as that girl had been. And she made it. She never had a drink the rest of her life. Well, I could just stand here and tell you all kinds of things about these. I want to tell you one thing about what happened the first banquet we ever had in AA. We have a lot of them now. You have them every place. Back in 1941, somebody got an idea in Cleveland that we ought to have a dinner and invite all the first people around. So I went out and made arrangements with the Lakeshore Hotel, which would take care of a couple hundred people. And I was going to have there Doc, Bill, Henrietta Seiberling, who introduced the two of them, and Bill Dotson, the first man, and Wally Gillum, who used to take drunks into his house and shake them out. And I was the MC. First thing I know, that Lakeshore Hotel can't handle it. So we had to cancel those reservations and go down and get a reservations at Statler downtown. We had our first banquet at the Statler Hotel. We had 989 people at this banquet. There was a couple hundred came after the banquet just to hear the speakers. Bill was there, Doc was there, Henrietta Seiberling, and Bill Dotson, Wally Gillum, and as I say, I was the MC. That was some party. The banquet at the Statler Hotel was $1.25. That was in 1941. And I had bouquets, I had, what do you call those?
boutonnieres for the ushers, and I had the ushers mix everybody up. The Canton people couldn't stay with Canton people, Akron people couldn't stay, mixed them all up. And we had corsages for all the ladies up on the dais there. And when we finished that banquet at $1.25, we had $7 left over. How do you like them apples? And that was some banquet. Those were some of the things that happened in the early days. I could stand here all night and tell you about some of these experiences. I don't know if you're interested in them or not, but you ought to. But I'll save some of it for tomorrow. We have a lot of things to talk about tomorrow. But I just wanted to get into the beginnings of AA tonight and let you all realize what wonderful thing you belong to and you are a part of and what your responsibility is. Because you and I have a responsibility. Because you and I, as I said before, are the only persons who can fix rummies. And let's confine our activities to rummies. Let's not try to fix the whole world. We have all we can pray over to take care of alcoholics. There are facilities for these other people. Let them go to those facilities and let you and I spend our time and our effort, our experience with the people we can work with best. I'm a great believer in planting where your seed has a chance to grow. And you and I can plant seeds among alcoholics and they will grow. It's been nice talking to you. I don't know how long I've talked. I'm glad he ran out of tape. This is nothing unusual. It's only been a couple hours, so that's easy. Anybody's a little behind hurting? Well, we'll close it up for now, and God bless all of you, and we'll get together sometime tomorrow. Thank you.